So at some point I'll get a green screen and then I can put gameplay footage behind me and be very professional.
Yo, we'll just slowly build our way up.
And then during like the MGS episode, it'll just be Kojima's face projected behind me the whole time. Yo, you guys follow him on Instagram, right?
Yeah.
He just keeps posting pictures of himself with celebrities and attractive women.
He's what Neil Druckmann wishes he was.
Oh, Druckburn. I just hope that Kojima, because he's very private about his personal life. I've tried looking into it before. I'm not sure if he's married, but I hope if he's not, he's just getting pussed by the spoonful, baby. I hope that man is swimming in a sea of pussy, baby. Welcome to Of Mics and Memory Cards, a complete rundown of the PlayStation 1 game library, all 4,105 of them. My name is Tyler, and if I was a toy, I would be the Princess Diana Beanie Baby. Today, I am joined by...
My name's Jacob. Howdy, howdy, howdy.
And I'm Cameron, and you know what? You guys have a friend in me.
Aw, that's really nice to hear, man. And I think we've all got a friend in Toy Story 2, Buzz Lightyear to the Rescue. You gotta say the full title. Have we all seen Toy Story 2?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, of course. We were born around the year 1990. We've seen it millions of times on VHS.
It was for us. I should have made time to like rewatch it again because it's actually been a few years since I've seen the movie from beginning to end.
That's why the game is so good, because it basically just plays the movie in little tidbits before.
I mean,
each
my favorite
level.
Part is the entire sequence where you relive Jesse's background while When Somebody Loved Me plays in the back.
Yeah, so I actually just finished watching it, or I didn't finish. I got right up to the end of it, and my wife came home, and when that started playing, that sequence, both of us just like fell silent and just like I had forgotten how genuinely devastating it is.
It hits so hard.
It is rough, man. And we were like, this whole movie is about, and all the Toy Stories, I think, are about accepting death, accepting aging, accepting that the flow of time moves ever onwards. You know, the Marvel Eternals? These are the real Eternals. They're the toys. They forever watch us as we grow old, but they continue on forever unchanging.
I love the idea that the Eternals are just toys in some sort of cosmic Andes toy box.
You hear that, Marvel? Make it canon.
Throw this into the next Kingdom Hearts game. That's right. We're talking about it again, baby.
Technically, since it's all Disney, and now with the announcement of King Zaddy, Pedro Pascal is going to be Reed Richards. Pedro Pascal could be in Kingdom Hearts 4. Yes,
I'm fine with that. He could be in Kingdom Hearts 4 as Reed Richards, and then when they go to the Star Wars world, he'll be Mando as well.
This is the way.
They should just not make Kingdom Hearts 4 and instead just make Pedro Pascal the video game.
You mean Last of Us?
Yeah, also that. Yeah.
No, you go to different worlds with characters that Pedro Pascal has played. So you'll go to the Last of Us world, you go to the Mandalorian world,
the Narcos world,
Fantastic Four world, the Narcos world. You can go to the unbearable weight
Mexico.
Of immense talent, and you get to also meet Nicolas Cage. I think it'd be perfect.
There have not been enough Nicolas Cage video games. I think I can say that full stop.
Speaking of Kojima, you know, Kojima and Nick Cage team up. Seems long overdue. Whoa.
Didn't they just... He posted a picture with Cage, didn't
Dude,
he?
I fucking hope so.
And those two slept together, too.
Yes.
He's just drowning in that Nick Cage-o-sy.
He's in the cage.
I'm done. I hate it.
Or the cage is in him. I don't know. One of the two.
I hate that. I hate me. I hate you.
I'm reeling it. I cast it out. The line has been hooked. Have either of you played this game in particular prior to playing it for this week's episode?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. Me too.
I played it on... I had the N64 version. So that one... If I remember correctly, I don't think that one had the FMVs that played before every level.
Correct. It couldn't handle FMVs. It was just still frames. I had the N64 version too. Yeah, it's still frames with text over it.
I used to love these, like when booting up this game and seeing not just Activision, not just Disney Interactive, but now I'm spacing on it. What's the other company?
Traveler's Tales?
Behind Traveler's Tales. And getting so excited every time I saw the Traveler's Tales logo play. And I remember buying, I remember renting, loving, and then having to return to the Blockbuster, and then buying Atlantis: The Lost Empire for the PlayStation 1. And that was a game, it just, all it has in common with this is being another Disney property, but it never got delivered. It never arrived in the mail.
That's rough.
It was rough. But this makes up for it, revisiting such a wonderful game.
I love Atlantis: The Lost Empire. I can't wait till we get to that episode because I just want to talk about the movie. That movie's dope. I have no follow-up to that. I just like it. And I think I don't think I put this in the outline, but we might as well mention it now. Traveler's Tales, now a huge company famous for the Lego games. So Lego Star Wars on the PS2 was kind of the first really big hit for them. They've been doing these licensed games forever, and then they're still doing licensed games, but I think they're feels like maybe a bit more pedigree behind it now, and they've just been milking that cash cow for more than 20 years now. So when we visit them, and we'll get to that in the narrative, they're still pretty young, but know that the gentlemen in this story succeed and are probably pretty rich at this point, I should hope, from that Lego Star Wars money, all those various IPs they've worked on. Disney, good, Marvel, and DC, I believe. So they should be rolling
in. Indiana Jones, Harry Potter, I think. Lego Harry Potters, too.
There's a Lego Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. That's right. And Lego Dimensions, and they just threw everything in there.
Bravo, Traveler's Tales. They sure have traveled a long way.
Hey, there it is.
They should tell a tale of it.
Do we have any prejudices against licensed games? Because I feel like at the time this came out, we were dumb kids who would get licensed games and not think too hard about their quality. But licensed games have definitely picked up an air of stink. Maybe at the time we were aware of that slight aura of smell. But I feel like now we look back and we go, oh, the developers just shit out fucking Wayne's World for the NES and we just ate it up.
Yeah, I definitely have that kind of aura of stink emanating off of me towards these games. But I don't really think that was from this generation of video game. I think that came about largely during the PS2 era. I remember being really burnt by Finding Nemo. That game was awful. I played it beginning to end, but I was very disappointed. And then the future Pixar games also sucked. Like, The Incredibles was not very well put together. At least back then, like, with Buzz Lightyear, it seemed like they were, like, there wasn't, like, a model for doing it on the cheap. That was just sort of, like, factory assembly, put the pieces together and put a coat of paint on it in the shape of this IP and you have a video game. It actually felt like there was a little bit more, like, they were trying to do. And by the PS2 era, it was just, like, I was really disappointed in everything except the Lord of the Rings, Two Towers, and Return of the King games.
Oh, man. They're so good.
So good.
Other than, like, GoldenEye 007, just, like, when it came to, like couch, same room multiplayer, or even, like, couch co-op, like, Two Towers and Lord of the Rings, like, definitely are up there.
Just Lord of the Rings, a video game IP that has been milked essentially to death with Gollum coming out recently, which is not good.
Like, literally to the death. That is.
I still want to play it just to see. I just have to see it.
I'm morbidly curious.
I would love, though, if we could get back to an era. Like, I would gladly take IP-centered games if it came with the resurgence of couch co-op, which I feel is quickly becoming a forgotten art. The games that do it tend to do it well, but there's just not enough of them. And if this year you were all like, hey, like, play Turning Red. It's the couch co-op game where you play the little girl who turns into a red panda and her evil bitch mom. I'd be in.
I think that's it's being very reductive of the plot of Turning Red.
I actually really like Turning Red. That's the Pixar movie I've most recently been all like, this movie, this studio still has it.
There's some magic left.
Something in there being beaten down by the Disney corporation. There's still some artists, I assume.
Yeah.
But to get to the end result of the game we're going to talk about today, we do have to follow two separate narratives, one for the film itself and one for Traveler's Tales and development of the game. Since Toy Story 2 is well known enough and we're, you know, a game podcast, I'm going to skim through a lot of the Pixar and the Toy Story 2 film narrative and just focus on the game's origins. But let's talk a bit about Pixar and Toy Story 2, the movie. Now, depending slightly on your age, it's pretty likely that you've seen something by Pixar. And I wrote depending on your age. I think it's an ageless thing. I think there is a large percentage chance that if you're listening to a pop culture podcast, you've seen a Pixar film. I cannot imagine a world where that's not the case.
No, I fully agree. It was 29 years ago that Toy Story came out. So you've had an entire generation to watch at least one.
We should put the spoiler alert. We're going to spoil some Toy Story 2. I bet you didn't know about the twist villain. Disney's been doing them for a long time.
It's also Hans from Frozen.
In the later 90s and through the 2000s, they were one of the few animation studios to consistently put films that were both critically lauded and commercially successful. Pixar got its start probably way earlier than you'd think, though, with the initial seed of the company planted in 1974 with the formation of the Computer Graphics Lab at the New York Institute of Technology. However, the core Pixar team, the original core Pixar team, moved from the Graphics Lab to Lucasfilm at George Lucas's request in 1979. This group would then spin off into an independent group in 1986, officially named Pixar finally, with funding help from majority stakeholder Steve Jobs. They're just hitting the big ones.
So many names attached to this origin story.
And so comes another. There's so much intricacy to the story of Pixar, some of which actually involves Nolan fucking Bushnell, co-founder of Atari and Chuck E. Cheese, but we're going to skip ahead quite a bit to Pixar's early relationship with Disney. Now, Pixar produced a short called Tin Toy about a small one-man band toy which caught Disney's eye and won the Academy Award in 1988 for Best Animated Short. The base idea of a living toy was then going to be worked into a 30-minute Christmas special, which was ultimately shelved. And as a weird quick aside, there was originally going to be a pink bear in this Christmas special named Lotso, which was then reworked into the villain of Toy Story 3 two decades later.
He finally got his time in the sun.
And during all of that, they just kept winning Academy Award after Academy Award after Academy Award.
Just constantly. I remember when it was just an assumption that if a Pixar movie came out, it would be the best animated film winner. Like, there was no competition for a long time.
Except for the Ghibli heads, who will forever be burned by the fact that they never got anything, despite the fact that they really should have on several occasions.
There's a legitimate argument there, but I think the popular vote was always cast for the Pixar film at the time. The 30-minute special went kaput when Disney CEO Michael Eisner and other Disney executives expressed that they really just wanted a full-length 3D film, which would be the first of its kind. Development of the film took 5 years and was released to theaters November 22nd, 1994. Toy Story. It was a massive success. The best case scenario that they had imagined at the box office was considered to be $200 million in profits, and it made $350 million. The film has a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, reflecting the near universal praise it received at the time. Everybody loved Toy Story. Because this was the Michael Eisner era of Disney, work on a sequel began immediately. However, it was originally envisioned as just a straight-to-VHS and DVD film of a lower quality, which was the style at the time. Nothing was assumed. It was actually possible that Toy Story 2 would be developed in-house with hand-drawn animation at Disney Studios instead of where it ended up in the Pixar canon. In an interesting gaming connection, while the standard Pixar crew was working on the film A Bug's Life, which had a PS1 game we will also probably cover at some point, the 95-person crew that became the core staff of Toy Story 2's development had been developing for Pixar's Interactive Group. They put out two PC games in 1996, Disney's Animated Storybook, Toy Story, and the Toy Story Activity Center. Between the two games, they had produced more Toy Story animation than was in the first movie. And then it was Steve Jobs who shut down the division entirely, the interactive division of Pixar, and then shifted them to work directly on Toy Story 2. So the movie begat games, the games begat movies, and these guys technically had more experience animating the characters than the original core team did.
Wild.
Super weird. There's a lot to cover with the Toy Story 2 development, and way more than we have time to cover here. And it's also not really our wheelhouse. Pixar received enormous pressure from Disney to rush the film along to the finish line. There was once a two-day weekend getaway with the writing crew where they basically bashed out the entire script. And at one point, someone on the animation crew deleted the entire film using a delete all command code in the wrong place. Luckily, someone had brought a backup copy home, so they only lost a couple days of work, but no one in the studio knew that at the time. They were just like, well...
So this is like the exact scene in Silicon Valley, if you guys have seen that, when they put the tequila bottle just on the backspace button, and it, like, deletes and like an entire Pornhub, like, cache of pornography.
I haven't seen it.
That is a hilarious show. Highly recommend it.
I do. Yeah, my partner loves that show. I heard about them accidentally deleting the entire film, and I think the reason somebody had a backup copy at home was because she was pregnant, so she was working remotely and had her backup copy. So thank God for pregnancy.
And that, billionaires, is why you should let us keep working from home.
Yeah.
The pandemic may quote-unquote be over, but I would really like to get some work done from my home office.
What you're trying to say is that if billionaires enjoy Toy Story 2, then work from home should continue. I think that's a motto we can all get behind.
It was extremely profitable because of the work from home model. The team frequently asked for delays and were always denied them, despite major shifts in the production staff behind the scenes. It's explained that this was for licensing partners for toys, promotional materials, and, well, probably this video game. The strain of overworking actually gave some animators carpal tunnel, and at least a third of the staff ended up with repetitive strain injuries. But before you lambast higher-ups for whipping them in the back to animate Buzz Lightyear faster, they actually imposed limits on work hours, the higher-ups did. But the younger members of the production staff purposely ignored all these rules for the sake of the product. True artists.
Wow.
Giving yourself hand injuries.
Young people, again, being scabs for the man. Go, go you.
And now they're in positions of power, and they're like, when I was younger, I used to ignore these restrictions.
It shows them, like, look out the window, and you hear, when somebody loved me, but it's just them, like, holding their arms in pain. Everything was beautiful.
Yeah, you know that bit? I think it's in Toy Story 2, right? Where Andy drops Woody into the trash can in, like, a nightmare vision, and then, like, the hands grab him underneath. Those are the hands that were thrown away by these people with carpal tunnel.
I don't want to play with you anymore.
They all have robo hands, and that's how Pixar still puts out so much work. Now, however you view all of the following, the movie was a success upon release, premiering November 13th, 1999 at the El Capitan Theater and releasing to wide audiences in the U.S. on November 24th. It made $511.5 million at the box office against a budget of $90 million and has been nigh universally praised critically as possibly superior to the original film.
And that's a price tag that nowadays Disney would consider a disappointment.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't make $1 billion, why are we keeping you around? We're gonna make everybody lose their jobs. It took home an Annie Award for Best Animated Theatrical Film and the Golden Globe for the Best Musical or Comedy. Not animated musical or comedy, just period, musical or comedy, an award it only shares with two other animated films, The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast.
Damn, that was a good solid year, because Lion King was 94, Beauty and the Beast was 92, and then 5 years later, not bad. All right, 90s, respecting animation as an art form.
In short, despite a troubled production, Pixar's third film solidified the company's place alongside Disney Animation Studios as a producer of high-quality works enjoyed by both children and adults, never sacrificing heart for the sake of taking the easy route, making a quick buck, an ethos they would arguably hold on to until Cars 2.
I didn't realize Toy Story 2 was their third film. For some reason, I thought it came out after after Monsters, Inc.
Yeah, it was Toy Story, Bug's Life, Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, The Incredibles, Cars, Ratatouille, WALL-E, Up, Toy Story 3, Brave, And then it gets murky for me.
Yeah. Wow. That was fucking impressive.
Yeah, that's a nice, like
a solid fucking run. Solid run of films.
For people who can't see Jacob talking, which is everybody, he didn't consult a screen. He did the memorize, like, look up and to the left. That was all ingrained within him.
That was all shots, baby.
Oh, yeah. And I had to stop myself from giving you the years as well that those movies came out.
Now, let's talk about the game itself. Now we're going to shoot back in time once again to 1989 with the founding of Development House that would end up making Toy Story 2, : Buzz Lightyear to the Rescue. Traveler's Tales was founded in 1989 by John Burton and Andy Ingram, headquartered in Cunsford, England. While there isn't much to...
Say it, Tyler. Say it. What,
I was like,
you should bleep it out from here on out.
The heavily redacted episode of Toy Story 2.
This is why it's an okay word across the pond, is it's just in every city name.
It is spelled, listeners, with a K, but otherwise it's Cunsford.
There seems to be no sign of intelligent life anywhere.
Hello and good evening. This is Tyler from the podcast you're listening to. I would first like to apologize to the people of Nutsford, for that is how, in fact, it is pronounced. I cannot begin to apologize for denigrating your great market town in Cheshire, England, located 14 miles southwest of Manchester. It seems you have many great rolling hills, old buildings, local characters, and what appears to be a satellite dish on Google Maps. I cannot begin to express the depth of my regret that I called you a name that is actually less offensive in your own country than it is in ours. I hope that you will accept my apology, even though your town is still named after a slang term for genitalia, just for the opposite gender. Now, back to your regularly scheduled programming about video games.
You are a sad, strange little man, and you have my pity.
Well, there isn't as much to be said about Andy, who I'm sure is very great and does good work in his own right. He's the graphics and texture designer for Traveler's Tales in those early days. There's much to be said about John Burton, who is another one of those weirdly unsung, brilliant early game designers who kept pushing systems to their limit, even if the games he was contracted to build didn't need to go that hard in the first place and weren't always super fun either, but technically often very impressive. John was born in Winchester, England in 1969, making him either 19 or 20 with the founding of Traveler's Tales. He began coding on his uncle's VIC-20, a Commodore 8-bit computer that was popular between 1980 and 1985, meaning that, given the time frame, he's another one of those kids who got his programming start in his preteen years, being somewhere between 11 and 15. A few years later, he acquired a ZX Spectrum, and I am, yes, UK listeners, pronouncing it ZX, though for us it's actually the ZX Spectrum.
A downgrade, in my opinion.
But ZX sounds right and frankly sounds cooler. But he acquired a ZX Spectrum, began to develop games of his own. He would occasionally send out games to publisher Firebrand, but he was always turned down at the time.
Dang, good for him.
Getting a jump early. Back in my day, I was coding on the ZX Spectrum. Punch cards. I don't think they were using punch cards.
Yeah, can you imagine this guy like talking to like his nephew who just like can't get a job? And he's like, back in my day, I used to design my own games. And I'd wake up at 5 a.m. and I would take a CD-ROM drive and I would walk 5 miles in heavy snowfall just to deliver and hear them say, thank you.
I love the Texan accent on the man from Winchester, England.
That's fair.
who is this in the hypothetical he's talking to? His grandson?
His nephew.
His nephew replies with, oh, well, I make hentai virtual novel games, and they're a hit on itch.io.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about.
It's okay, uncle.
Oh, I have a Patreon for my non-con furry interactive novels, and I make millions.
Oh, man, I hate the word.
I say good for the nephew. In the mid-80s, I would guess around 1987, Burton got an Amiga, a 16-bit system that, for our American audience's knowledge, was incredibly popular in Europe, specifically in the UK. He began developing for the machine, immersing himself in the Amiga demo scene at the time, making his own games and messing around with existing ones. It's in this scene that he met Andy Ingram, and the two began developing a game that would later become their first release, a fantasy side-scrolling action platformer called Leander. And we all have played the shit out of Leander, of course, haven't we?
Yes, oh, yeah. Leander's just about 15 miles north of Austin. I go there frequently.
On our childhood Amigas. Leander? I don't know. None of us know.
I've never heard this game before today.
we got to pronounce it in Andy's voice. Leander.
Leander.
Leander. From Winchester.
Yeah, come on. Don't give me a hard time. The British place is named after a gun.
And the other one's named after a piece of female anatomy. The pair would quickly show an early build to developer Psygnosis, a major UK publisher and developer known for pushing graphics on these microcomputers to their absolute limit. Look up Shadow of the Beast, a 1989 Amiga release to see the kind of work they were doing with parallax scrolling and detailed sprites. Psygnosis took a liking to the pair and acquired the game for publishing, much to the boys' surprise and delight. They were given 18 months to finalize the product, almost all of which was done while Burton was still in college at Liverpool Polytechnic, and the pair decided to found a company for their work, which was called Traveler's Tales. The company would develop two more games, Bram Stoker's Dracula, based on the 1992 film, and an original product called Pugsy, before their first Disney finance game, Mickey Mania, The Timeless Adventures of Mickey Mouse in 1994.
Well, is that the title? Were they The Timeless Adventures of Mickey Mouse in 1994?
No, the game came out in 1994. Thank you.
Just needed a little bit of clarity.
I appreciate it. I did not properly italicize the title in the outline, so I can see how it would get confusing.
Horrible proofreader.
Well, the game itself lands around a pretty okay as far as fun goes. It's visually quite striking, and would give Disney enough trust in the pair to develop Toy Story, which was the first game, Toy Story, in 1995 for the Genesis/Mega Drive and the SNES. Also, I feel like people may have heard this factoid before, but Mickey Mania is the first game that David Jaffe, the father of Twisted Metal and God of War, designed for. Now you know.
Right on.
There you go.
He was hurt by Disney, man. Twisted Metal and the original God of War, he had a lot of aggression to get out of his system.
Blood in his eyes, staring at that
little
mouse.
Still does, apparently. He hates where current God of War is, the direction the current God of Wars went.
And boy, howdy, is he wrong. You know what I hate? I hate when characters grow and change and learn from their mistakes. God, nothing worse.
No,
I hear what you're saying.
I won't accept anything more than one dimensions.
But in 2024, I think what we're all looking for in our media is something to replace the anger and aggression that is just out there in the world every day. We need more just Kratos banging babes and then ripping their heads off. Sticking his hands down the severed head to retrieve a key. I forget exactly what it was, but it was brutal.
Where are all the sex minigames? Oh, excuse me, the sex QTEs.
X. Square. Triangle. Circle.
I failed the sex minigame in God of War 3 so many times, and it is so frustrating to go through that because it like pans over to like two other women who then just like shake their heads and look away if you mess up the QTE, and it just takes forever, makes you feel bad. My manhood was diminished.
Yeah. If I had a nickel every time I was looked at disappointedly by a woman in the game, of course.
Fun fact, QuickTime events are my wife and mine's like code word when we talk about like planned sex out in public.
Is that real? That sounds like it could be real.
It does, doesn't it? And I will neither confirm nor deny.
You know what? I don't care if it's true or not. I'm going to go ahead and believe it.
I'm writing all this down. And then, dear listener, we will continue to redact. None of this is going to make it. Now, there's a lot to be said, and I realize this is like the third time I've used this phrase. There's a lot to be said about the development of Toy Story for the Genesis and the Super Nintendo. This is not necessarily the place to tell those stories. But I would instead direct interested listeners to Burton's YouTube channels. He has one called Game Hut and one called Coding Secrets. He goes very in-depth about the actual code used to write these programs, which include one of the smoother first-person sequences on 16-bit consoles, which just so happens to take place inside the claw machine in Pizza Planet in goddamn Toy Story 1. I don't know.
That first game is also so good.
It's good. You can see snippets of his early demo scene work as well as materials from some canceled products. There's going to be a Mickey Mania 2 that he's got a lot of beta builds of, but there's nothing on anything Disney related following about 1998, and I assume this is when they started having him sign NDAs, when they realized that games were going to be more than just toys, especially as the games were developed alongside the films themselves, and so could give away some of Disney's more internal secrets as well. So I looked through these channels hoping to find something on Toy Story 2. Nada. But a lot on Toy Story 1.
I had completely forgotten that games back then, based on existing property, really did release around the time of the movie. We talked about the Lord of the Rings games earlier, but I remember withholding from playing Return of the King because I think it came out like the same week that the movie came out, and I didn't want to have it spoiled for me, knowing that they use scenes from it in the actual gameplay.
We'll go over it.
On the other side of that, there's GoldenEye that came out like, what, 2-3 years after the movie? So there's that.
And still like didn't follow it sometimes, if I recall?
No. No, it branched out and gave James Bond more to do.
Good for him. And there's not enough Sean Bean in that game.
There is not. There really isn't. I think there's more Alan Cumming than there is Sean Bean in that game.
Alan Wedding?
redacted. Alan Cumming.
Bleep that out. Traveler's Tales would draw Sega's attention and develop Sonic 3D Blast and Sonic R around the late 90s. While again, these games are no great shakes, they're pretty visually engaging for the time. And weird fact of the podcast, I don't know where else to put this, Burton is pretty highly religious and occasionally slips Christian references into his games. I think he's got some on the back end, but the only one that is actually visible to the player you can find in Sonic R, it's the Jesus fish, the Ichthys? Is that how it's pronounced? Shots, do you know?
Ichthys. I don't know. I have no idea.
It's the Jesus fish, you know, the one that's on everybody's bumpers. But it's hidden in one of the tracks. I think the first track, if you go through a door and then like turn back around, you can see the fish on the side of the door.
Interesting. So,
there is a Christian reference in Sonic R. Now you know. After working with Psygnosis again on the PS1 title Rascal in 1998, which was considered to be one of the worst video games ever made at the time, though critics liked the graphics. Are you noticing a pattern here with these guys? Traveler's Tales was still trusted by Disney and Pixar to make the game adaptation of A Bug's Life, Pixar's second film, also released in 1998. That game and Toy Story 2 were both published by Activision, who published everything around that time. They weren't quite the evil corporate megastructure that they are today, but they were flirting with it.
Also back then, they weren't owned by Microsoft.
Or joined with Blizzard.
I love monopolies.
Yeah.
Hey, did you guys see that Xbox is like not going away? We were texting about this all week. And
yeah.
It was like, no, we're not making hardware anymore. Actually, we're going to double down on hardware and the next one's going to be the most powerful thing ever. And we're going to put Hi-Fi Rush on Switch. Like,
Is awesome. I'm glad.
Which is
Hi-Fi
cool.
Rush deserves to be played by more people.
Now, what's weird here is Traveler's Tales through all of this was still mostly just John and Andy. They picked up a few frequent collaborators along the way, like David Dutson and Chris Stanforth. The operation was still John's show to program and design. Looking at the credits of Toy Story 2, this is still mostly the case. While Dutson worked on 3D engine programming, and there are quite a few additional art designs for characters, backgrounds, and terrain, I get the feeling that the game, so far as we would consider it a game, the level designs, goals, etc., pretty much all John.
That's dope.
To be fair, like, it is impressive for him to do all of that, but if you also look at, say, the level design, goals, etc., it's not that complicated. Like, if I had the programming skills and a bottle of whiskey and, like, a free afternoon, I think I could do it too.
I mean, Mario 64 had already come out. You just gotta do that again, but make it Buzz Lightyear.
And to be fair, like, like almost every mission had like one where you have to get coins for Ham, one where you had to like erase RC. So yep. like it's a lot of repetition.
Not to like that, same five missions then, every level. Yeah.
And the level design was just based on levels in the movie.
Not to shit on all of his work though.
Fuck you, John.
What do we know?
I would guess that production on Toy Story began more or less immediately after A Bug's Life, if not sort of in tandem with it. Bug's Life shipped for PS1 in November of 1998 and for N64 January of 99. That would put production for Toy Story 2 somewhere between a year and 11 months. The game was built off the engine for A Bug's Life, evidence of which can be found in some Bug's Life still screens, still being present in a demo disc for the PS1 and the final Windows version of Toy Story. So you can find Bug's Life screens in some versions and some demo discs of it.
Interesting.
It seems to me that the bones of the game came together fairly quickly, with a preview build shown off at E3 1999 with a build date of May 7th, certainly not being finished, but having at least four of the eventual 15 levels entirely built, and the core mechanics of the game were already in place. And this is as good a place as any to mention the music, which has no right to be as good as it is. It was produced by a company called Swallow Studios, which consists of two guys named Andy Blythe.
What studios?
Boop. Studios. Come Studios. Andy Blythe and Martin Joustra. They worked with Traveler's Tales as early as 1994 with Mickey Mania, worked on the first Toy Story game, and stayed with the company off and on until 2003's Finding Nemo.
No!
You foreshadowed without even knowing it.
Jacob's mind is blown right now for you listeners out there.
It's actually amazing. I have this superpower where I can see just a few minutes into the future. You might as well call me Mr. Webb. I remember learning about this game with my mom in the Amazon researching spiders right before she died. This episode's going to be released so late. Like, that joke is not going to land.
We'll have swung back around to, like, Morbius being popular again, and people will be like, no one talks about Madam Web anymore. And actually, it's been recontextualized, and now it's like, I don't know, a feminist masterpiece.
Now Madam
we're going
like
to get shit
best,
on for shitting
best
on it.
Movie, the best movie that ever came out.
Madam Web 2.
Can't wait for all the Kotaku Electrical articles movie. That are, actually, Madam Web is very good.
I can't wait to play the PlayStation 5 Madam Web video game tie-in.
By Traveler's Tales.
Yeah.
Lego Madam Web. What was I talking about? The music. After the 2003 Finding Nemo game, they worked on a PS2 Europe-only Peter Pan game. That's their last game credit. The two now seem to develop some kind of software for licensed music for TV and film. It gives people pre-written tracks that can then be broken down and changed, like stems of music that then can get recomposed to use the same track as a different song. It's kind of neat. I don't fully understand it, but seems like a way to kind of make your own music on the cheap that they just license out to people.
Yeah, I would love to look into that.
That sounds really cool. I've heard from a lot of my like film circle, people who are way better at it than I am, that kind of reminds me of sort of modular filmmaking, which is this very real fear that that's sort of like the direction the industry is going, where you almost have like building blocks that are almost like open source. And that you can take it and you can sort of build your own movie out of like pre-existing assets, which becomes even more available with like AI. And you mix music into that. You really could, we could be living like 10, 20 years in the future in a world where like no movie is a monocultural event. It's just like, just make whatever you want with these pre-existing renderings, and now you have your own fan movie that can live in your head and you don't have to talk to anybody ever.
That's scary. Well, even now with that new AI, I don't even remember what it's called, but that basically you just put in a prompt and it can make a movie for you. Like, that's freaking terrifying.
Yeah, don't love it. Get out of here, Swallow Studios. Why don't you go swallow your own bleep?
I don't think it's AI. I think you actually get the stems and you have to move them around yourself. So I don't know if that's good or bad. I don't know. I'm not the filmmaker or musician.
That sounds better than AI.
I don't think it's AI related, though.
And because I feel like it was composed by a human, and then you're just allowed to break it up and rearrange it.
Yeah.
Well, there's probably a whole philosophical discussion there that we won't get into, but I will say, that second track, pretty good. It's a little doo-wop ditty. Hey, Toy Story 2. The game eventually released on November 16th. This would have been 1999. Now, this was a few days prior to the premiere of the film, but about a week... this was a few days after the premiere of the film at the El Capitan, but about a week before the wide release, meaning that much of the movie's plot, including the villainous twist of Stinky Pete the Prospector, spoiler, could have been spoiled to any overeager children who finished the game within that first week before the movie came out. So exactly as you were saying.
But no child in their right mind would have spent their time playing this game, because that weekend, a different movie premiered at number one in the North American box office. Do you guys know what movie it is?
What's the year again?
1999, November 16th.
Is it The Matrix?
It's not The Matrix. Let me give you a hint. It was an animated movie for which we all got a gift at the box office when we purchased
Pokemon the first movie.
It was Pokemon the first movie.
Oh, no shit.
Cameron, you didn't even let me finish the hint. It was like you were given a gift. Pokemon the first movie.
Because I got that Mew card. We all got the Mew card.
I think I still have it. Wow. I can't believe this was around the same time. For some reason, I put those in totally different, like, I don't know, categories of eras of me. On my eras tour, one of them was Pokemon and the other was Pixar.
Well, that's only because, Tyler, on the weekend of November 21st, between Pokemon the first movie and Toy Story 2, we were given another Pierce Brosnan 007 movie, and that was when you went from one era to the next.
There it is.
That was the paradigm shift.
Which one was it? Die Another Day?
The World Is Not Enough. Die Another Day wasn't until 2003, and that movie is a tragedy. It's tragic.
The reviews for the PlayStation version were average, settling around 6s and 7s out of 10s. While, again, the aesthetics of the game were praised, the gameplay was criticized, particularly the camera. Still, of the early licensed Traveler's Tales releases, this seems to be one of the better regarded entries. As far as sales go, it was among the top 10 best-selling PS1 games of December 1999 and sits just under 1 million in U.S. sales alone. Did about 640,000 copies in Europe. Well, the game was later released as a greatest hits title with the horrible, garish, awful green box art. This version seems incredibly difficult to locate to the point that I'm not actually sure it exists. I tried to find any for sale. You can't. It's on some listings as being part of the Greatest Hits line, and I feel like I swear like I may have seen it when I was a kid, but I'm not sure if it's real or not. So that's a
what
mystery.
What person in their right mind would give up and just even think about putting up for sale a Greatest Hits title? That is a treasure that you keep forever.
There is a 1.1 version of the game, specifically because of a problematic enemy that shows up in the back third of the game. Starting in Al's penthouse, a stereotypical Mexican gunslinger enemy appears, which was an original creation of the game. No such character has appeared in either of the films or in any of the related media. The design features a thick, dark mustache, a bullet bandolier, and a sombrero. Shortly after the game's release, a peaceful protest of 120 mestizo activists took place outside Activision's headquarters.
I have a puppet from the 90s that I got in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. That is a red-faced Mexican with a gun and a bottle of Corona in a sombrero hanging on my wall because street vendor gave this to child me when I was like 6 years old. I'm sorry. I'm amazed that he's apparently in this game.
In Toy Story 2.
It is. So, like, in the game, he's got a big mustache and he's a little, like, thicker, but that is remarkably close to the character in the game that was so
my God
racist that there was a protest outside of Activision.
I love the fact that this character did not exist in the movie, and then for the game, they're like, hey, how can we make this racist?
Yeah. To be fair, okay, I don't know if anyone watches any Great British Baking Show, but the most infuriating episode of that television production, the one that more or less made me stop watching it, is they did a Mexican-themed bake night of like, or Bake Weekend of, God, and it was something weird. Like, one of them was tacos, and it's the Great British Baking Show. So they're like bakers. They typically make like, you know, cakes and pastries. Yeah. And the only baking portion, I guess, was the tortilla, but you know, that's like fried. And so the rest of it was them making like guacamole and making some of the worst looking tacos I've ever seen. And everything else in it was equally problematic. But I just remember one British woman couldn't say guacamole and was like, I got to make the guacamole. So if I they are half a world away from Mexico. They are much less physically close to Mexico than, say, we in the States are. But I still don't want to cut them some slack. It's pretty racist looking.
Is that true? I need to consult my globe just to make sure.
It President was a Biden time over before here. The internet connected all of us so thoroughly. They were like, we didn't know. I'm not sure.
They're anyway. Like, do they even have dessert in Mexico? I'm pretty sure they just eat tortillas. Sometimes they make them into chips. And there's guacamole. Salsa? Okay.
Nephew, back in my day, we could put whatever we wanted in our video games, and no one protests. Well, I guess they did protest them. There were protests.
And they got turned into redheaded prospector types.
Yeah. So now, Jacob, you're the one who gets shot with lasers.
What a gift.
But yes, so in subsequent releases, so assumedly the greatest hits version and any discs produced after that original pressing, the character was then changed into something that looked more like a Stinky Pete prospector type, redheaded. It was like a white shirt, like jean coveralls or whatever. So if you play the digital versions, which are really easily accessible now, that's the character you're going to see.
Thanks for helping me figure out my Halloween costume for October 2024.
Let's go.
Without further ado, though, let's get to the game itself. Now, we can start with maybe Buzz's moveset. He's got a laser, the same laser mm-hmm. you see in the films, but this one can be upgraded to a little, like, green super laser. If you find just it's just a glowing green stick. It looks like
I didn't know what that, it looked like, I thought it was Rex's tail at first. I'm like, oh, do I have to, like, bring Rex's tail back to?
It looks like the inanimate uranium rod from The Simpsons.
Oh.
And so when you find it, you have a little like meter in the bottom left where you can charge up, and it'll make the little laser sound, and that just turns into a green bar, and then you go pew 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 pew, and the green laser shoots faster than normal.
I love that they gave him a real working laser rather than just a light bulb in the movies, because it was such a huge point of contention between Woody and Buzz in the first movie that his laser wasn't real.
Yeah, you're right, Cameron. I wish this whole game was the exact same game, but instead of any actual move sets, Buzz Lightyear was really just a toy.
You just try to shoot your laser at other toys and they just, nothing happens.
They just annihilate you, man.
It could be the Dark Souls of Toy Story games.
You're right. This isn't lore accurate, so it's literally unplayable. Buzz can double jump. His second jump does the thing where it like shoots out the wings, or I guess wings is the best term for it.
Yeah.
From his back, and then he kind of springs forward. He can spin, which doesn't seem to be taken from anything in the movies, I can tell, really. You can charge up the spin too, and it's just his top half. So the top half just goes voom, 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 while his legs are still walking around. And if you charge it up all the way and then spin, you'll actually get dizzy, and then he'll kind of have to pause for a second after, which makes some boss fights really annoying.
I'm pretty sure that there's a scene in the first Toy Story. Maybe it's when he thinks he's Mrs. Nesbitt and Woody's trying to, like, get his attention, that, like, Woody full-on spins him around. But don't quote me on that. My Toy Story trivia is rusty.
Gotta hit up the Wikia. He can do a butt smash, as was the style in 3D platformers at the time. You jump up mm-hmm. and hit the action button, and he stomps down. I frequently forgot that you could do this, because it doesn't actually come up that often. Usually use it to, like, bounce off of something and go a little higher.
Or whatever,
rather than as an offensive move. and then there's 5 add-ons. I would say this is sort of a proto-Metroidvania. It's not. But there are some items that you get from later levels that you can then return to earlier levels to get stuff that those items can unlock. So there's a shield, which is just a little bluey thing that you roll around in. You get that in the first level, and then you just have it forever. There's a disc launcher, which is takes the place of the laser. There's some enemies that you can only defeat with the disc. There's a rocket boost, which helps you with races and getting over stuff. A grappling hook, which only comes up like twice. And then hover boots, which also only comes up like twice. Most of these only like come up twice. You find it in one level, you remember which level you need to go back to get the one Pizza Planet token, and then you go back and you do it.
Those hover boots were rad, though.
They are
proto cool. Ratchet and Clank.
There's some Ratchet and Clank here, actually. I can see that.
Yeah.
And actually, kind of when you go into the first person view, which is L1, which has Buzz's reflection a full 3 years prior to Metroid Prime.
Yeah, that tripped me out.
Especially because it's like, it's Buzz like winking, like focusing, and he's like, ooh.
He's kind of got like Popeye. The Pixar face. Yeah, the one like cocked eyebrow.
Is that the Pixar, the DreamWorks face?
DreamWorks face. God, yes, thank you. Sorry. DreamWorks face.
The Megamind.
And R1 locks onto enemies in this view, and then also like things you can destroy in the environment to undo latches or free up like cabinets that then open and close on their own.
It was also extremely, because I was playing this on PSP, right? And so there's no L2 and R2 to move the camera around. So it's like you can kind of use a little bit with like movement, like the camera. It's like if I start moving left, suddenly like the camera will adjust a little bit like behind me. And you can use the thumbstick to also like, you know, do that movement. But for the most part, it's like, it's just really awkward and really clumsy. Mm-hmm. And so frequently when I was fighting an enemy, I would have to switch into first person mode, lock on, fire, 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 and then get out and then run away. And it was never as easy as like, because if you press L1, like you're in first person. It's not like you hold it down and when you let go, you exit it. Mm-hmm. It's like you click, you're in, click, you're out.
That's what I ended up doing to adjust the camera. Like not in like during the boss fights though, but just like in general when you're doing like especially the platforming sequences. Like I relied on L1 a lot to just recenter the camera, like go into first person view, get back out so the camera's behind Buzz.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's worth noting that you can't move in first person view. It locks you to where you can still jump. No. Weirdly, but it locks you in place. This is pre twin stick shooter, so there's no way play it all as a Halo game.
This is what I think people have to realize is you're not playing Buzz Lightyear. You're playing the pilot inside of Buzz Lightyear. That's why the controls are so difficult.
Check out episode 3 of Mics and Memory Cards to get that reference.
You know, I would play a first-person Buzz Lightyear shooter.
Totally.
That actually sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, only though if the reflection is there the entire time.
And never changes. He always stays like with the one eyebrow cocked and smiling.
You'll hear
like
the voice lines and just his mouth is not moving.
Can we? Okay, I will. I don't think I ever wrote this in, but Buzz has like 5 lines that he'll just spout out randomly. And it's just the same ones over and over. And I blocked it all out. I can't think of what any of them are right now, but and I think it's like a per level thing. You just get one per level. Where he's like, no sign of intelligent life anywhere.
Yeah.
Except when I played this, I could not find a great emulator. And by the time I finally found one, I didn't realize until I had it installed that it was the French version of this game.
Oh.
So everything was just, you know, Buzz Leclerc, allez, rescue.
You know what's funny? I also ran into an issue emulating it where I have my little handheld devices. Like I have an RG. Which one is it? I have an Ambernic handheld device, and I tried playing it on that at first. But for some reason, whenever you talk to a character, you know how it like the camera changes to like you know a different like view while the text bubble comes up. For some reason, whenever you transition from gameplay to the text bubble, the device just could not handle it, and it would glitch out and like slow down and just like, and then on your way out it does the same thing. So I had to like find an emulator on my computer to like actually play it. So I'm thinking, they're like, why is this of all things that the game has to offer the thing that can't be handled on this tiny little device. It just blew my mind.
I will say, though, I think this does give me, like, people use Duolingo, but from now on, I think I'm just going to play, like, rated E for everyone games from the PS1 era in French.
Oh,
so that way, like, yes. I could, like, practice it.
Yeah.
Not bad, right? You could, hey, salut, Buzz. Si tu me rapportes 50 pièces, se te donnerat un jeton Pizza Planet. Sounds cool, like not 100% what you want, but I think it's pieces for Pizza Planet. Thank you, Ham.
Hey, Buzz, need some coins up here.
Oh, yeah. God.
Good, holy fun. Damn.
That was solid.
Oh, thank you. Because you hear that a lot whenever you go near Ham. You hear that often.
Well, and then some of the voices, they clearly couldn't find actual like clips from the movie that worked. Like, I don't know if either of you got to Al's penthouse where you see Jessie the first time, but she says, like, hey, Buzz, over here. But it's clearly not, what's her name?
Joan Cusack.
Joan Cusack.
It's clearly not Joan Cusack. It's definitely like the one woman they had around the office that they roped next to a microphone and were like, say the line.
Yeah, that's weird. You would think of all women, someone could come up with a decent Joan Cusack impression.
She's trying, but it's definitely not her. Yeah. And I don't think they've got, well, I don't know. It might be Kelsey Grammer. Because all the Stinky Pete says is like, ow. But, you know, someone could probably fake Kelsey Grammer going ow pretty easily.
Yeah, you could just watch an episode of Frasier. It's got to be in there.
Oh, baby, hear the blues are calling. I love Frasier. There will be, as stated previously, there will be no Frasier slander on this. Now, did you guys know there were two camera options, though? Because there's that's preset. Which sucks. And then so the preset one kind of stays behind Buzz and is maybe if you don't have an L2 and R2 button, the better way to go. But there's a different mode called, I think, passive mode, which plays more like what we would think of a third person game today, where you have to press L and R2 to move the camera around. It shifts, I think, a little bit with your movement and to not collide with objects. But I swapped out and found that to be a far superior camera system as I went deeper into the game.
Funny enough, I did get the like little tutorial bit that told me that, and it told me again in French, and I did translate it, and I understood how to do or what I needed to do. I just never really got around to how to do it.
What's this? El pause? Le pause?
Le pause.
Now, levels. Every level has, as we stated, 5 objectives, and they never change. You can get 50 coins and talk to Ham. You fight a boss. So there's sub-bosses in each of the regular levels, and then every 3 levels, there's a larger boss. We can go over it later. You find 5 lost little guys, different little guys. Just some little dudes, little critters or little alien guys, depends.
Little army men.
Yeah, they're army men, sheep, twice the Weeble Wobbles. I'm trying to think of what else. The green aliens. I think that's about it. There's some other ones in some of the other levels. A race or a speed challenge. So this is either you're racing the RC car or weirdly Slinky will be like, get 5 things in this amount of time. It's like the most annoying one is the construction level. You have to jump around some what is basically quicksand to find like 5 wrenches before they disappear in 45 seconds.
Oh, I remember that one.
What does Slinky need with 5 wrenches?
Terrible things. We got to bleep it out.
A dog could do many things with 5 wrenches.
And then the last one is find a hidden thing. So typically that seems to me like the quote-unquote central objective of the level. So it's usually after a platforming challenge or at the top of a platforming challenge, or you have to do one specific action. So that's the one that can kind of change up based on what level you're in. But otherwise, every single level follows this formula. I'd say about half the levels, the first time you visit, you can get all 5 tokens. And then the other half, you have to come back for at least 1 or 2 of the tokens with one of the add-ons that you get by getting Mr. Potato Head's pieces, which are every 3 levels or so, a potato head piece has fallen off. You find it, you bring it back to him, and he unlocks a box. And then you can pick up one of those items from the box and then profit.
On the subject of Potato Head, his voice acting in the French version, really good. I think Mr. Potato Head is a missed opportunity to have a French character in the Toy Story franchise.
Monsieur Potato Head.
Monsieur Papa Frit. Or maybe that's Spanish. Ooh. I don't know.
Yeah. Papa Frit.
Potato in French.
What I thought was funny.
Pomme de terre.
Oh, pomme de terre.
Monsieur pomme de terre. And then whatever head is.
I love it.
Okay, potato head in French. Tete de pomme de terre.
Yes, tete de pomme de terre.
So it'd be Monsieur tete de pomme de terre. God damn.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was the villain that 007 killed in The World's Not Enough.
You definitely played the best version of the game, I think.
I had no doubt.
So I found something interesting that, like, kind of, I don't know if what it means for the implications of, like, Toy Story lore, but the second level, the boss is a Zurg kite, mm-hmm. and it's like, so that kite is sentient. So are kites toys, or, like, what gives something sentient to, like, come alive in this world, you know? Like, do they just have to have, like, I don't know, look like a character or something? Because, like, can you imagine your existence just being a kite?
It's, Cameron, it's a little bit like Voldemort in Harry Potter. Zurg split his soul into seven different pieces, and one of them was a kite.
Actually, they bring that up in Toy Story, is it 4, the one with Forky?
Yeah, I haven't seen the fourth one.
It's fine. But
Kevin, what? You gave up after the trilogy? You never saw Toy Story. Legitimately, though, Toy Story 4, don't really give a shit. But there, like, the villain in it is genuinely spooky.
Okay. Oh, yes. Yeah, I'll give you that, definitely. And that feels like maybe they were sitting on that one and trying to find a use for her, because it felt like... spooky doll. Yeah. But Toy Story 4, so the toys in the Toy Story chronology have been passed on by Andy to a new girl whose name I don't recall, but she's
Bonnie.
Like a preschooler. Thank you. And she makes a fork toy, I think, at school, and just gives a plastic fork, a face, and some spork. Oh, it's a spork.
From like the little pipe cleaners, right?
Yes.
I thought it's not Forky, it's Sporky.
No, I think you're right. I think it is Forky, but I'm pretty sure he's a spork.
Either way, he's voiced by Tony Hale of Arrested Development.
Oh, right
fame,
on.
Buster Bluth. But he's given sentience by the child, by drawing a face and stuff on him, where it would be implied that were he just a fork and or a spork, he would not have sentience. Mm-hmm. So it's a great question. I don't know
if you take a kite and make it into a character, then they're like, oh, I'm alive now.
It would actually, and this would be interesting because Forky wants to die after achieving life. He's just I'm not supposed to be sentient. This is misery. I feel awful and I can't stop. Put me out of my misery. But Woody won't let him. Woody holds him to life against his will. And you can imagine that the Zurg kite, after being split off from Zurg's soul, probably also just wants the sweet release of death. So he searches out Zurg's mortal nemesis, Buzz Lightyear, to destroy him. And in the second level of Toy Story 2, Buzz Lightyear... to the rescue, Buzz arrives at the rescue of the Zurg kite.
Fucking brilliant.
All the toys, he is rescuing every toy that he destroys because toys don't want to exist. What does the immortal want more than to be mortal?
This is easily, we just wrapped up 3 episodes on Final Fantasy VII, and now we're getting into the deep philosophical questions.
And also, when you kill them, you get rewarded with Pizza Planet tokens. The tokens they're basically the stars in Super Mario 64. So you get 5 of, they're like the big thing that you get per world. And so every set of 2 levels, it's 2 levels of boss, 2 levels of boss, 5 tokens per, so a 50 tokens total. I will say, I don't know if I've mentioned it yet, I don't know why I was compelled to 100% complete this game. I got all 50 of those fucking tokens.
Let's go.
Dude, good job.
I wouldn't say it took me that long. I mean, by the time you finish the game, you've got most of them just by getting them.
That would have been
the hell of it.
such good content for this channel.
The levels themselves are pretty large. Often the interiors are segmented into distinct zones. So it's kind of like levels within levels for like the penthouse or Andy's house. There's like a kitchen section, a bathroom section, with its own kind of, it's usually just like climb up some stuff, figure out a way to get up there. Hey, you got up there. Way to go. Now go up somewhere else. There's a lot of verticality to many of them. The construction zone in particular is very tall to the point that it, like, you hit switches to basically unlock a, like, fast travel back up because it's so likely that you'll fall at some point and lose, like 10 minutes of progress. Yeah, exactly. Honestly, it's not that far off.
And that's actually when I played it originally on the N64. I think that was the level I got stuck on, and that's when I stopped playing.
I think that's the make or break one where you're like, oh, this isn't that fun anymore.
I got my fill. I'd rather watch the movie.
Yeah, Majora's Mask just came out. I want to play that.
You do only need one token to finish a level and move on to the next one, but different levels have different token requirements. So at some point, you'll need to get more than one per level. The last level doesn't do the verticality thing. It's a giant empty flat space with a big plane just going in a circle in the middle. And it's not quite, like, to scale. Like, it's not really, like, what an actual buzz would be to, like, a 747. But it's pretty large. And that level's very boring. Because there's nothing to jump on. You just kind of... And it's got, like, a Silent Hill haze around it. Foreshadowing. Where the draw distance can only go so far. So at some point, you're, like, kind of walking into a black void, and then out of nowhere, it's Ham.
I think you're forgetting about the element where the plane is circling because the cabin's not pressurized, and so just panels from the airplane are flying off, threatening to hit Buzz. That's a current events joke for people listening, watching the story out of United or Alaska Airlines in Portland and Boeing. It's all good. I read the news. I'm old.
It landed in like near the apartment building that my partner and I used to live in.
The door did? The wall?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was up here.
I know it was up there.
It's like a teacher's backyard.
That's crazy. I didn't even think. As soon as it wasn't on the plane, in my...
off into the aether.
Yeah. It's object permanence, right? It wasn't there, therefore it doesn't exist.
Coming at you with current events like Madam Web and that airplane whose door fell off. Hope you're enjoying this 2 months in the future. Hope that's all still relevant.
Hey, did you guys hear about Ocean Gate?
I really hope it's not.
So the levels in order. The journey that they go on, you're in Andy's house, you go to Andy's neighborhood, then there's a construction yard, alleys and gullies, Al's toy barn, Al's spaceland, an elevator hop, Al's penthouse, airport infiltration, and tarmac trouble. So you follow generally the course of the movie. You can tell that some of this is padding. I don't remember the toys going into any like back alleys for a significant amount of time or a construction zone.
You're telling me I was only stuck on the third level. I'm so mad at myself.
Yeah, there's a lot more game. And actually, I really like the toy barn level. It was very fun. The penthouse level is fun. The elevator is another very, very vertical one that has two big elevators that just go up and down that you can ride up and down, but they're timed and it takes them like maybe a minute and a half to get from the top of the level to the bottom, and it's just a little like it's a little dull. That's the level you get the hook shot in, but they don't do anything that interesting with it. You go into first person view, you hook onto a thing, and then you're up there. It's like jumping but more.
That's
but
always more how I've thought about grapple hooks. It's like jumping but more.
And then the bosses, there is a plane, a toy plane, there's a question. The toy plane seems sentient because it attacks you. And there are other toys in the universe that don't have, like, faces or humanoid features, but are sentient. So,
yeah.
At what point does it attain sentience?
Right, because, like Etch-a-Sketch. Yeah, the Etch-a-Sketch walks around. The Speak and Spell walks around. There's a, like, wooden train set that Andy has that just rolls around the room. But Battleship doesn't come alive.
Right, a game doesn't come alive, because there's also video games in the world. Toy Story 2 starts with them playing a Buzz Lightyear video game.
Yeah.
But the video game, and I believe by proxy, the console, are not sentient.
Yeah, they don't explore that until later with Wreck-It Ralph.
The second boss is a slime ooze for reasons I don't understand. And that was the first boss where it was like, oh, we're doing the British design philosophy of just kind of a battle of attrition here, where there doesn't seem like a way you can win it without just kind of getting hurt and just eating the lives that it damn. Because when you die, you don't like get shot back to the start of the level. You just resume back where you died. So even if the boss has been damaged or whatever, like it remains damaged. So it's just like a bigger health bar more than anything else. And with some of these other bosses, especially at the end, there's one where I could not figure out how to avoid the damage, and you just spin at it and get hurt and just do more damage than he does because your health bar is higher. It's not great. There's a UFO that spawns other enemies. You fight Zerg at one point, and then the last fight is Stinky Pete with a gunslinger and a blacksmith. You actually fight all three of them, very unceremoniously fight Stinky Pete in like the second to last level, and then fight him again with two other sub-bosses at the end. So the last boss is just three sub-bosses cobbled back together at the same time. And that's really all I have to say about the game.
Yeah, it was pretty fascinating the first time I died, and I was just like, wait, so there's no punishment? Nothing, it doesn't matter? Like
Not a single consequence?
I could just hang out in the ooze and die?
All
right.
Once again, all the immortal wants is to be mortal. They can't die.
I can't wait to pick up the, the Dow, according to Toy Story 2, Buzz Lightyear to the rescue.
The true ending of the game is actually if you let it get a game over screen. Otherwise, it just loops infinitely, and you just have to keep playing it.
True ending is going outside and touching grass.
I didn't get very far in any of my playthrough of this game, but I'm assuming Woody comes into play at some point later on. Like, is he like a quest giver in later levels, or is he just not an element in this game at all?
It's Buzz Lightyear to the rescue. to the rescue of who, Cameron? Andy? You think Woody. Andy's being held hostage by Zerg?
Woody. Yeah, the Woody model shows up only in the last section, like during that last boss fight, up in like sitting on some baggage in a plane where the fight takes place is a little Woody model and a little Jesse model. And he goes, oh boy, you gotta help me, Buzz. And then afterwards he goes, thanks for helping me, Buzz. And then you get a film clip of the end of the movie.
We could do legitimately, I think, I want to say like, because Tom Hanks had a ton, I don't know, maybe it's not Tom Hanks. I want to say it is, but there's like a couple of actors who just voice like a bunch of animated characters or like their movies wound up being like adapted to video games. Maybe even Tim Allen. And there were like, the actors who would play those voices in every game, even though it wasn't the original actor, it was some actor who could do like a convincing portrayal of that person. And we could do a whole episode just about like an actor's filmography there.
In the case of Tom Hanks, if he is not available to do the voice of Woody for like a game or like anything that isn't the major movies, it's his brother.
Yeah, Jim Hanks.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It's Tom and Jim?
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude.
So it's probably Jim doing the one voice line here, but in anything that,
thanks for saving me, Buzz.
Yeah. In anything where he's not making millions, if you hear Woody, it's probably Jim.
Yeah, very cool. Big fan.
Fascinating. Does anyone else have anything to say about the game itself before we kind of move on to the aftermath?
Not so much. I mean, I was genuinely surprised that, you know, it still kind of held up. Like, I know it didn't get the warmest reception back then, but it was nominated for a Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards back at that time. But other than that, it was still, I still found it fun. Like, I understand how you were compelled to like 100% it, because I didn't want to move on from one level until I got all of the Pizza Planet tokens from it. And then you get to where it's like, oh, you can't get this one because you need a piece from Mr. Potato Head further on. Like, Rex literally tells you that. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, fine, I guess I'll just move forward.
Yeah, I thought, while we've been talking about it, I was thinking, I like the model of the levels in that they're really just built around kind of exploring. Granted, it's the same gameplay mechanic, level after level, but that's really what the game is there for. It's not trying to tell some sort of like supplementary story, or like in my least favorite version of a video game story, the Lord of the Rings, the Third Age, the like Final Fantasy turn-based ripoff, where it follows a crew of like not the Fellowship, but like their equivalent, just trailing behind them basically in case the Fellowship fails. And so it's literally just the story beats from the game, but with different characters. And then when like the story is completed, because from the movies, the main characters completed the story, like you don't get a resolution. The game's just over. It's like, oh, they did it. So the B team wasn't really necessary. Here, it really is just a design to give you the opportunity to play around with like the gameplay loop that they've created. And I don't know, maybe like roguelikes are kind of what do that now, where there really isn't like an emphasis on story. It really is on level design and just playing around inside that level. I don't know if that's the closest contemporary to this kind of gameplay, because even most platformers had a story that you were progressing throughout, even if it was, you know, get revenge on Neocortex.
I feel like there were two schools of thought, and I think there's always been two schools of thought with the pro platformer. It's been either the reach the goal, and the subheading of that would be reach the goal as quickly as you can. So typically the straight line, your Mario's, your Sonic's. And then for a long time, the European design of the platformer was something that is mockingly called the airplane hangar design, where it's a huge level that goes out in multiple directions, not necessarily one direction, and the point is to collect many things. And so
the collectathons.
Yes. And so what's interesting is the collectathon on the 16-bit consoles, you'd see that kind of thing in Amiga games, something like Zool, but you'd also see it in a lot of bad license games like Home Improvement or Mighty Max or whatever.
Oh yeah, I was just gonna say, like, the Donkey Kong countries kind of have that DNA in it. To the point where like, I think even Miyamoto kind of criticized it. I think he was a little harsh on it back then, but I think he's more recently warmed up to it.
Well,
but
what's funny
he did not like how you had to collect, like, there were just so many things to collect.
Well, what's funny is that's what fucking Yoshi's Island is. Yoshi's Island is the first kind of collect-a-thon produced, I feel like, by a more Japanese-leaning production staff. And then that leads pretty straightforward into the design philosophy of Mario 64, which is a very wide open space where you may have one goal that you go to, but the point is more about like kind of the playground. And so that airplane hangar design moved from something that was European centric to something that was then universal, because you were seeing it in those Japanese design houses, and then Americans would try and ape that with their platformers as well, and that became the style at the time. So your Glovers, your Banjo-Kazooies, your DK64s, your Toy Story 2s all leaned more towards that kind of platformer, while you still had something like Crash, which was still using the Sonic Mario ethos. Yeah. And then the collectathon definitely died, essentially with, like, I would say it tried to hold on for the PS2. The last one I can think of that was like, I think had any significant marketing push was Vex. I don't know if you guys remember that. Vex.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah,
please look up Vex after this. Vex was, they tried to do like a dark character platformer where it had the same design philosophy of like,
oh, I've seen this character.
You've seen this ad. I'm sure you've seen this ad. And he has these like big claws and he looks mad. But it's just fucking Banjo-Kazooie.
I did play this game.
I played it. I liked it.
Oh, dude. Yeah, that Vex dude. He was hot.
Wait a minute. Brian Cox voiced the villain in this game?
Really?
No effing way.
I didn't know that. But to me, Vex was the death knell of that. And then it wasn't until we all got a nostalgia boner for that style of design when we all grew up and were like, why isn't anyone making those games I liked as a kid anymore? And then you had like Yooka-Laylee, which is not very good. And then I would say like maybe A Hat in Time is the most successful 3D platformer to sort of ape the style. But you're right, Jacob. There's not that this type of game is very specific to its era. And I feel like it's one of those things, much like how a boomer shooter now is really just aping boomer shooters of the past and often don't have too much to say themselves. Like, that being said, like, Dusk is just Quake, but perfected. Dusk the game is maybe better than Quake the game. It's fantastic. I think there's the possibility that we could see games like this in the future that are genuinely good, but I don't know if we just have nostalgia for these games because they were of the time, or if there is genuine value to them. Like, I still like going back to play Mario 64 and Banjo-Kazooie, but only those two. I tried playing Banjo-Tooie recently. That game's balls, dude.
It's not good. It's too big for its own good.
That's an airplane hangar.
Yes, that's the sort of the trend that happened, and now there seems to be a concerted effort where games want to give you a sandbox, but a smaller sandbox. In fact, Tyler, you use the term in describing the airport hangar. At one point you said playground. And I was all like, that is kind of what you want, is you want a playground with lots of different equipment in it, but a confined space, but different things that you can go and do. Different just opportunities to like play the game in this style. Actually, probably the last game that I played that really achieved this was Astro's Playroom on the PS5.
Yeah, which is super fun.
Yeah, and just as a Sony fan, like an Astro.
You're right. That's the closest thing.
And it was really good. And it was great with the haptic controls.
When we get a PS5, I'm jumping on that.
Dude, it's so good.
Yeah, it only takes a few hours. It's great.
Yeah, it's really fun. Can you imagine like playing this game on like the PS5 like haptic controller, like double jumping and like maybe feeling like a rumble in the controller as like the wings went out? Or just the different things that you could do. Like the laser, you could like hold down L2, and it's just like Returnal has a great thing where it's all when you go to fire, you like main fire is holding down the trigger buttons halfway, and then they have a special alt fire which is takes longer to charge, and you have to pull the trigger down all the way. And you would think that that would be like really annoying and that you would constantly be trying to do alt fire, but it is so perfectly designed. I would just love Buzz Lightyear to the rescue with haptic controls, is what I'm saying.
Remake Buzz Lightyear to the rescue. Disney, Pixar, Traveler's Tales, use a
you
sliver
cowards.
Of that money.
You do cowards. It. Do it. We want it. The fans demand it.
We three guys that two people are listening to at best demand it.
You're going to eat your words.
Two of the three of our partners, one of them is lying about listening. And actually, but the shots that leads us quite well into other versions of Toy Story 2. The PS1 game was re-released as a PS1 classic for PS3, PSP, and the Vita. And then in 2022, included for PS4 and PS5 via PlayStation Plus. These are by far the most accessible way to play the game today and come with a rewind and save state feature built in. Weirdly, this game is playable on every generation of PlayStation console.
That's fantastic.
They knew their priorities.
Now, there's ports. So the N64, PC, and Dreamcast all had ports. The PS1, N64, and the PC/Mac versions all released at the same time to coincide with the film. They're essentially identical, though graphically, to me, the N64 version seems a little bit smoother, but the music on the PS1 definitely sounds nicer since it's CD quality. The N64 is also unable to play the FMV clips, as we talked about, opting instead for still frames and text. The Dreamcast version was delayed and released in July of 2000. This is probably the best version of the game as far as how it looks. It looks the best and sounds the best, though it's entirely based on the PS1 version, so it's just kind of up-rezzed. And I've read on some forums that the analog control is really wonky, like they didn't adjust for the Dreamcast's sticks. The DualShock for the PS1 would have been out at the time, so they would have designed for those sticks, but I think the Dreamcast version was... The whatever the analog was for Dreamcast was different. They maybe didn't kind of optimize that as well as it could have been. I don't know. This is all third-hand information from forums from kind of around that time. So your mileage may vary. Now, we're going to get into the weeds here, boys, just because I can. The Game Boy Advance version was released November 11th of 1999 and developed by Tier Text Design Studio and published by our good friends at THQ. I played it for a bit and I found it absolutely fucking dreadful. Like, it was so unpleasant. You hold B to run, and then you press B again to jump, so you have to, like, let off it for just a second and then repress it, and he jumps forward, but he doesn't jump forward at the same way that he jumps up, because if you're standing still, you just jump up at a certain height, but then when you're running, you go, like, bleh, and do, like, a weird, like, kind of Prince of Persia-style leap forward. There's a mechanic in the first level where you have to jump off a ball and fly, and I've seen it in a YouTube video, but no one in the comments knew you could do it, and the manual's been lost to time. I put in a solid 20 minutes on this first fucking level, and I could never figure out how to jump off of the post onto the car and then jump on a ball and then fly. It's bad. It's really bad. The music was fine, and Buzz's face on the title screen is frightening.
I'm looking up that title that title screen right now. I gotta see this for myself.
Tyler, yeah, the mistake that you made is that you have to jump off of a ball and then fall with style.
Yes, thank you. Where were you 2 weeks ago?
His face looks awful.
It looks really bad.
He looks like Sloth from the Goonies.
There is, now we're getting into the deep weeds. There's the Toy Story 2 Activity Center, which is a collection of mini games, mostly riffs on existing arcade games. There's a Street Crossing with Cones game, you know, the scene where they cross the street with the cones and they can't see.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Frogger rip called Cone Chaos. There's like a cross between Burger Time and Mappy with robots in a toy store. It's called Toy Shelf Showdown. There's a tactical board game that's like chess and checkers matched up with Woody playing against Bullseye the Horse. It's called Critter Corral. There's like a Maze Cubert mashup with Buzz bouncing around luggage in the airport terminal. It's called Luggage Lunacy. And the last bit is a comic/scene maker that Disney Activity Centers used to just love. And I remember playing with those when I was a kid.
I haven't played any of these.
You're harping on these, but I really feel like these are just like the mini games in Kingdom Hearts 3.
Will we go an episode without referencing Kingdom Hearts 3? The answer is no.
And I feel like this is a fine episode in which to mention it. Because Kingdom Hearts 3, yeah. It is Disney, and it's also when they finally did a Pixar level. And they did Monsters,
yeah,
Inc., and they did Toy Story. And the Toy Story level is so fucking weird. Because, yeah, you're in, like,
I loved it.
Like the mall, like toy store. And it's, like, kind of cool in there. And then because, Tetsuya Nomura was all like, let's just throw every game style into this game a little bit. It's all like, all right, so at one point you're going to hop into these mechs and you're going to fight them. And it's kind of cool when you're in the toy store. But then you, like, go into the video game and it is some weird, like, post-apocalyptic, like, Armored Core 6 style world that's on fire, and you have to, like, battle these other mechs, and you're like, in a Kingdom Hearts game? Where did this come from? It makes no sense.
I think it was an old concept that Tetsuya Nomura had for maybe one of the Final Fantasies that he was working on, and then it got shelved. Maybe it was there were some concepts left over from when he was, I think when he was in charge of Final Fantasy 15 / Final Fantasy 13 Versus or whatever. And he just, he's like, I have these ideas, man. I gotta get it out. You know where it's gonna go? It's gonna go into the Toy Story level of fucking Kingdom Hearts 3.
On one hand, like, I kind of love it. That's what I always loved about Toy Story. Or not about Toy Story. It's always what I've always loved about Kingdom Hearts, the weird mashing up of ideas. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It was just too weird, I guess.
It did give us the moment of, I think, I can't remember what boss you were fighting, but where Sora is, like, about to, like, run in and fight, and then Woody is just, like, puts his hand to the side. No, I gotta do this.
Yeah, that's right.
Such a badass moment from Woody, of all people.
Yeah, way to go.
From Jim Hanks.
What's the line from Toy Story 2 when Goofy fucking dies and Mickey says,
from Kingdom Hearts 2?
Yeah, and Mickey goes like, they're going to pay for what they did or something. The series is the series is built on that incongruity.
where Donald's trying to do the Zeta Flare and Goofy's like, Donald, no!
God, you guys are really good at these voices.
I've played a lot of Kingdom Hearts too. all right, we're going to move on to the edutainment. There's Toy Story 2 Operation : Rescue Woody for the V Smile. Have you guys heard about the V Smile?
No.
Hard really? No.
Me neither. This came out for a system I'd never heard of for children, a purely educational, quote-unquote, TV learning system. Now, it didn't have cartridges. It had smartridges. It was produced from 2004 to 2010. Toy Story 2 Operation : Rescue Woody came out in 2005, which is a full 6 years after the movie. It released technically a year closer to Toy Story 3. You can either go on a learning adventure or select the learning zone. And while it's supposed to be educational, it looks like another collection of minigames and platforming bits with occasional math or word problems thrown in. But sprite work looks pretty nice. So, there you go, everyone. Now you know about the V-Smile and Toy Story 2.
All right.
But that's not all. Are you both aware of the Sega Pico?
Yes. Sega Pico. That was the Mexican level in the Sonic the Hedgehog game.
Yeah, they had to patch it out later because there was a, actually a protest in front of Sega's offices. No, the Sega Pico, which I do think I had this one, Ray. I played with it at maybe a dentist's office. It doesn't have like a game pad. It's a kind of a soft pad that's got a grid on it, and you get a little stylus pen, and whatever you click around on the pad, it's mimicked on the screen. So kind of a Nintendo DS, but from the 90s.
From Sega.
Yeah, Sega. Sega does what Nintendo does 10 years later. So we've got Toy Story 2, Woody, Susaku, Daisakusen. Anyway, it translates to
Susaku Daisakusen.
I think you got it, actually.
It was the accent.
With a loose translation being the creative strategy of Woody. Now, the Pico was released in all regions, but the game itself that we're talking about was only released in Japan. So if you watch the long play of this, it's all of the like Toy Story characters have their little like talking heads, but it's all exclusively in Japanese. And I would say the only languages better than French for these Toy Story characters are Japanese. I really like Ham's Japanese actor.
Awesome.
From what I can tell, this Japan-only release came out around August 2000 and seems to be another collection of minigames. Follow the plot of the film with some shockingly good sprite art and music. It's not some kind of lost gem, but it was popular enough in Japan to get a re-release in 2003 for the Pico's three-year anniversary. Aw, good for them. There's also a board game called the Cone Crossing game that you can watch two big sweaty dudes play online. That's not pejorative. I love them, but that's the only video I could find of it. I also found a bunch of Flash games, one of which is considered to be lost media, and the people on the lost media subreddit are going ape trying to find it. They can find the page that it was played on, but they can't find the Flash info itself. Toy Story 2, : Rescue Woody. If anyone out there has it, I'm sure there's people who would be very happy for you to give them that Flash file, but we don't have time to cover anything else here regarding that. There's two more Toy Story games that would release on the PS1, which conceivably we'll talk about one day. Also both designed by Traveler's Tales, Buzz Lightyear of Star Command, which was based on the 2D animated show of the same name. Put it on Disney
Plus,
you cowards.
Show, by the way.
It's not streamable right now.
It's so good. Patrick Warburton is Buzz. That's such solid casting.
Not only is that solid casting, but one of my favorite villains of all time is from that show. The energy vampire, Nos4A2. Great.
Yes.
Name.
And but I've listened to something recently about why that show is not like viewable, and most people theorize it's because it's highly sexual. Because the little robot guy is super horny, and then there's the lady
XR?
With like, yeah, and then there's the lady with the big head.
She's got like kind of turquoise skin. Oh, no, I don't know her. Because he has, like, three partners at Star Command.
Yeah.
And one of them's, like a ginger turquoise woman. Like, basically the color
of my
iPhone.
Yeah, she can walk through walls.
It's like Minerva, I think, is her name.
She can walk through walls? Oh, that's...
I'm pretty sure that was her power.
That's highly erotic. Yeah,
and that's Nicole Sullivan, so another good voice actor. Oh, my God. But no, there was like a slinky like femme fatale, but with like a giant nebula or like a Saturn head.
You can't describe a woman in a Toy Story adjacent property as slinky, because I definitely was all like the dog.
I missed that entirely. She's actually a sexy slinky dog. Make it happen, artists online. Rule34.com.
It's already there.
Oh, no. Okay, Control Shift N, and we'll look that up. We'll look that up later.
I'm gonna save that for later.
Anyway, that the game that that was based on released in late 2000, and then Toy Story Racer came out a few months later in March of 01. It's just a Mario Kart clone. They're doing what they gotta do.
All right,
pay the bills. In conclusion, Toy Story as a brand has never really gone away, meaning that the games have never been too far behind. Toy Story 3 actually had a dedicated licensed platform game released for all current systems at the time, which was the PS2, but also the 360, the Wii, the PS3, etc. And that was in 2010, which is well after the licensed game boom of the 90s and 2000s. I've always felt the release was a little anachronistic because of this. Toy Story characters would appear in titles like Disney Infinity, and I'm sure they appear in all of Disney's many mobile titles. There's also a great Disneyland ride. I think it's called Toy Story Mania, where you have this little like pull gun and it like moves you to like screen to screen and you shoot at little targets. The wait is always 45 minutes, but it's a good time.
That was good. That. But I know, yeah. I'm thinking of Buzz Lightyear Astro Blasters is what it was called when I was there.
Also fun. Like, the yeah, wait, that's, yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of actually.
That one's in Disneyland. Toy Story Mania is in California Adventure, I think.
Got it.
It's really important to me that you get this right, what with all the Disney rides that show up in Kingdom Hearts 3. Now, while I, and I'm sure all of us, can admit this is not the finest game we've ever played, I felt myself coming back to it throughout the week. There is a simplicity to it, and I cannot deny the warmth of nostalgia, not only for this game and this film, but for this era of product. There's a soft warmth to it that soothes me, despite of and in spite of its faults. It serves as a reminder that games, like toys, have the identity given to them by their creators, but are then given a secondary life built by the kids who experience them. See, I find a kind of Marie Kondo-esque joy not just in games, but items. There's a power in recognizing the effect that they had on us, however small, because even a quiet smile of a sliver of childhood joy can burn brightly in the dark days we find ourselves in now. Rather than feel silly for playing with games and toys into my adulthood, I choose instead to focus on the joy that play can bring, and I celebrate the rough edges of this game as I celebrate my own. Neither one of us is perfect, but both of us are trying our best to carve a moment of joy in a chaotic world of noise.
How fucking profound, man.
I think what you're trying to say there, Tyler, is at the end of the day, you've got a friend in these games.
Bring it back around, baby.
Thank you once again for joining us for yet another episode of Mics and Memory Cards. Please join us again next week when we go over the fantastic Silent Hill for the PlayStation 1. In the meantime, please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. And as always, I'm Jacob.
I'm Tyler.
And I'm Cameron.
And you've been listening to Of Mics and Memory Cards.
You got a friend in me.